Okay, folks, just before we start, I have a bunch of handouts. These are the exercise for computation and logic. I'll explain a bit about what it is just in a moment, because we're not quite ready to start yet. But maybe I could distribute, just to save you getting them from the back, I'll hand them out here. And you can pass, just take one and pass one back. If you don't get one, then they'll be just, I'll leave whatever is the remainder at the back. Quite a lot of people here. So I'll give you, maybe a bit more. You're getting it. A bit more. How many do you need here? Something like that. Just pass them back. And you guys just grab as it comes up at the back. How about that? It's a long walk for two folk. There you go. It's yours. One, two, three, four. Actually, I could do you individually. How's that? That's personalized. There you go. There you go. Oh, yeah, one of those. So hopefully that's all going around. Thank you very much. And you. Great. Here, have one of these. Is this still going around back there? I don't know if there's enough. Oh yeah, probably. So if somebody up at the back ends up with some left over, then when you're coming out, could you just leave them at the... There you go. I've ended up standing here dishing these things out. I didn't really mean to, but there you go. I'll leave the rest of these out at the back. Do you like one of these? Okay, so before we properly start the lecture, so what I've handed out here is the compulsory exercise for computation and logic. Now, I guess you already know, but the compulsory exercise doesn't attract a mark, so makes no difference at all to your final mark for the course how well you do in this. You can score a zero, and it makes no difference for your final mark, because the final mark in computational and logic is just on the exam. So you may be wondering, why are we doing a compulsory exercise? And the reason why is to give you a little bit of practice and a bit of a chance to get a bit of feedback at this particular point in the course. So quite often what happens with people doing computational logic, a lot of people, you know, you're working well and everything is going fine and so on, and you're prepared for the exam, or you're just a whiz at preparing at the last moment for an exam or something, and that all works out fine for you. But there will always be people who sort of don't quite get it and don't quite realize that they haven't, and therefore actually start working and practicing, and doing things too late. And so this is meant to be the sort of thing where you get a chance to calibrate a little bit. I have gone through pretty much, you haven't gone through all of the tutorials and so on, so you're a little bit You haven't got all of that practice behind you, so don't get too shocked if you don't do too well in this, because there's a bit more of the course to go. On the other hand, you have seen pretty much everything that you need by now. As I was saying at the last lecture, if you missed the last lecture, pretty much I've done all the technical stuff you really need for the exam. All of these lectures are just because it's a good thing for you to know. So the purpose of this is practice, basically. We do want folk to practice, though. So why is it compulsory? I could just give you this. The reason it's compulsory, and you do have to hand it in, is because we want to make sure that everybody does a bit of practice. So if you're a complete idiot, you can do this, score a zero, hand it into the ITO, nothing happens to you. Just that you're an idiot, that's all. I mean, that's fine. That's okay. But it would be much better if you actually used it for practice. Do make sure that you hand it in by noon on, it says, Friday the 19th of November. So why a specific time? Because then if we don't get these things handed in from people, that's a signal that we have people who are really finding it difficult with the course. You know, not even looking at this and something is going badly wrong in my view. So that's why there's a specific hand-in date. This is for you. It's not for your assessment or anything like that. It's just to help you do a bit, understand a little bit more of the course. Of course, tutorials should help you as well. Of course, the WebCT stuff should help you as well. If you want more practice, you can go there and so on. But this is a little bit extra, and it allows us to see just a little bit of how people are doing. So I'd say try your best for this. Another little tip for this particular one. The questions that are in here, Tom French was actually the guy who prepared this one, so thanks to him for preparing it. But the way it's prepared is to try and make it as close as we reasonably can to the sort of questions that you might see in an exam. Okay, so there's two ways you can do this, right? And depending on where you are in your own preparations, I'd suggest you do one way or the other. So one way of doing this is actually you do it under time pressure. Give yourself a couple of hours or something to do it. Something sensible that you feel is kind of realistic for you. Try and do it under a bit of time pressure. And then that gives you an idea about how you can do these things when you're having to do them in a fixed period of time. Only do that if you're really pretty confident, I'd say. Because probably you're not quite prepared for doing things that quickly yet. But that's a possibility if you feel you're really... and then it would be very good practice. The other one is don't do it under time pressure. Take as much time as you need and just see what you understand and what you don't. If there are bits where you feel that you've really got gaps, then that's the sort of thing to take into tutorials, because there's still quite a few tutorials going through. So you'd have time to correct. Or try it on WebCT, try some of the self-testing stuff. Okay, so this should help you a lot. If you use it wisely, this helps you a lot. If all you do is null return, stuff it into the ITO, well, you missed an opportunity. Okay? So that's that. The other thing that's... I haven't actually handed out individually. I left them all outside. This is something that a university is doing, which I think is important, and I think it's a good thing to promote. It's a simple little thing, actually. It's a free bookmark, is what that is. You can get a free bookmark. You can probably you could have two. I think we have plenty. You could have two if you want. Give it to a friend, whatever. I think this is going out a lot in the university. The idea of this is mostly to give you an idea of the sort of feedback that it would be nice for you to get, because you're new to this. You don't really know maybe an awful lot about how it is that somebody might tell you something that would be useful for you to understand how you. Tackling the material. This gives you a few sort of simple tips about how to do that and the sort of things that you should expect in courses. And generally, there are simple things that you should expect, like where there is some feedback to be given, you should get it reasonably promptly and so on and so forth. So this is not just for Informatics 1. This is just the sort of thing that you could, in later years and so on, that would be useful for you just to have in mind. So I think it's a useful thing just to have a look at. Doesn't take long to look at. It gives you a free bookmark. How's that? Okay? Right. So now on to the material. Let me see there. Okay, so as you know, I'm now on to the lectures that I thought, well, it's just good for you to know. So I think one thing that it's good for you to know is a little bit about logic programming. I asked the question about that before, and a lot of people have done logic programming before, right? Is that still true? How many people have done logic programming? Not too many, actually. I thought it was more. Okay, good. Okay. Even if you have done logic programming before, I'll bet there are things I'll talk about here that you haven't seen, unless you've done it quite a lot, because I want to give you an idea of the sort of thing that logic programs do for you. Why am I doing this? Two reasons. One is because I think it's nice for you to see how logic, the sort of thing that you've seen, links into actual programming, right, because you haven't seen that before. And the other thing is programming language jealousy, I have to admit. You're getting a lot on functional programming, and I want to see you a little bit of logic programming, just so you can get an idea of what that's like. Okay, so a little bit of programming language envy. I mean, so you have to allow me this. Okay, and there'll be a few examples I go through, and actually, the cunning thing is, some of the examples, not all of them, but some of them link into things I've told you before. So that's the cunning bit. Okay, so the first cunning bit is I wanted to try and explain to you prologue in terms of natural deduction. So I'm going to give you the prologue language, which is much, much the most widely used style of logic programming, many other styles of logic programming, but this is the most widely used one. If you want to use Prologue, actually I haven't checked this year, but I believe that Sixtus Prologue, which is the version I'll use, is available on the Dice machines. I think you type Sixtus if I remember correctly, and you get it, if for some reason you become fanatically interested and want to try it. Okay, so remember the natural deduction proofs? You have proofs, you have subproofs. If you wanted to write something that would give you the sort of proofs that Prologue gives you, pure Prologue, there's more to Prologue than just this, but pure Prologue gives you, basically it's this. True is a primitive in Prologue, so it always succeeds. False is a primitive in Prologue, it always fails. So true is a special symbol that will always succeed. If you've got A comma B, then that behaves exactly like the AND that you saw before. So to prove A and B, you separately prove A and you separately prove B. The F here is your set of Prologue clauses, your Prologue program. Right? So where we had set of axioms in our propositional logic, here we have a set of clauses. Okay, and actually the other slight wrinkle to this is, because this is a programming language, there is an order in which you do this, so you'll try A before you try B. So in pure logic, logic programming is basically, at the very highest level, logic programming is the struggle between having to think about the order of things and not. And typically a logic programmer, in a pure sense, never thinks about the order of things, like whether A is or B is done first. But in practice, sometimes it does matter a little bit. So there's always this tension in logic programming. It's very hard to explain that to you in detail just standing here, but there always is if you're a programmer. OR is represented by a semicolon. So this is A or B. To prove A or B, you prove A or you prove B. This is exactly the rules that you've seen before. All I've done is change the symbol. This was an OR, this was an AND, and this was an OR before. Here, we have, if we want to find a proof of A from our set of clauses, then we look to see if there's a clause that's A, and then this is like implication pointing to the left. B implies A. B implies A is in our set of clauses, then we try and prove B. That's it. And remember when I was talking about resolution and talking about Horan clauses? Horan clauses is always exactly one thing on, in this case, the left-hand side of the implication. These are Horan clauses. Right? And you also get negation as failure. Remember what I was talking about, if you want having a single rule for negation where you have a closed world assumption for not A, then you can succeed with not A if you can't find a proof for A from your set of clauses. That's it. That's the pure Prologue interpreter described. That's all there is to the language, basically, plus all of the additional stuff that you do that connects it into everything else. Actually, that's not all there is to the language. Really, I'm lying a little bit, because there are some control structures and so on you can build in. But for pure Prologue, I'm not lying. Okay. So here's a Prologue. Now, just to give you an idea, here's a natural deduction proof. And here's your set of clauses. P is true if Q and R are true, and Q is true. Remember, this always succeeds, and R is true. And so then I expect to be able to infer P, right? So Q is true, R is true, P is true if Q and R is true. Yeah, obviously we'll be able to infer P. So to prove P, we use rule 5. So P of Q and R is inside my set of clauses. There it is. Then I try to prove Q and R, and we use rule 2, prove Q and R separately from our set of clauses. That's my set of clauses. Prove Q. Q, if true, is in my set of clauses. So it's the same rule as before. There's an implication in here. And then I can trivially prove true. Same for R, right? Okay, so it's just like any other natural deduction proof that you ever saw. Okay. Right. What makes it a bit more complicated is, of course, you've got lots of variables and data structures, which I haven't talked about yet. And I'm not going to give you a course on Prolog in 30 minutes or so. So there's not a lot of time to talk about that. But I'll give you some idea by giving you some examples. And here's an example. Remember this one? Remember when we were doing the finite state machines, I took a little bit of trouble to say, okay, well, in logic, we can define our finite state machine. So actually, what we'll do just now is I'll dip out of the slides, and I'll go into looking at the Prolog codes. So the thing to do is just mentally, just look at that. Just hold that in your mind a little bit. I'm not requiring you to remember what it means. Let's go back here. And now what I want is that guy. This is a piece of Prolog. And this bit, a bit there, is identical, modulo syntax, to what I showed you on the slide. So this bit of Prolog will accept, given some, I've identified, well, actually pretty much it is identical. This is the name of the model that you're using for your finite state machine. And this is going to be the sequence. And accept it if the model is defined. For example, here's a, ignore the prob one because that's going on to something slightly different. Here's one for binary odd. Actually, maybe I need a, so what that's saying is binary odd has two states. Remember how we define a finite state machine model? It has two states, one and two. It has alphabet one and zero. Initial state is one. It has a single accepting state called two. And here's my transition function. I can go from one to two with the symbol one. I can go from two to two with the symbol zero, and two to two with the symbol one. So let me draw that. Let me draw up that finite state machine model. Maybe I can do it here. Right, so if we look at the transition function, the initial state is 1. So here's state 1. It's my initial state. Okay, and I know that because that says that's my initial state. There it is. Then I can go from state 1 to state 2 with a 1. So here, that's state 1. State 2 with a 1. I can go from state 2 with a 0 to state 2. 0. I can go from state 2 to state 2 with a 1. 1. That's my finite state machine. If I'd drawn it as a diagram, that's, I'm sorry, it's quite difficult to read, but okay? So what that's doing is that's giving me the transition function. These guys aren't so interesting, actually. This is my initial state. This is where I want to get. Then here are my axioms, these two, for how you accept it. If I've got a model, as I defined, and I've got one of them up here, for example, for binary odd, there's model defined. Then I can accept, given some model name, some particular sequence. And the sequence will be a list in Prolog, thing with the square brackets. So a sequence might be 0101 or something like that, or 1011, something like that as a list. But I've got a model for it, and then I can have a trace. And trace is the thing that's actually doing the real work of the proof for me. So what trace says is I have a trace from the initial state, given the sequence that I'm trying to accept, to the accepting states, given the transitions that I've got defined. And the transitions came from the model, so the accepting state so did the initial state, right? Those variables match. Right? So then trace from wherever I am, if I've got nothing left, if I've got no sequence, given the accepting state succeeds if where I currently am is an accepting state. So I don't have to use any symbols to get from where I am to an accepting state if where I am is an accepting state, right? That's the, in the jargon of the field, that's the base case. Simplest possible step. Here's the recursive bit. From where I am, given some symbol and some remainder, some bunch of accepting states and some transitions. If I've got a member of my set of transitions that takes me from where I currently am, given the symbol, next symbol in my sequence, to some new step. So Q1 is a new variable, right? Some new place. And I have a trace from that new place, given the remainder of the sequence as the first element, and then the remainder of that set of that sequence to the accepting state and the transitions, then I also have a trace. That's the recursive bit. That takes me one step nearer to an accepting state. And if I can keep going one step nearer, I'm eventually going to, I'm going to eventually get to nothing, and then I should be at an accepting state. That's how it works. So then if I want to, let me show you that running. So we've got the model. Let's take the model, which is the binary odd one. So if I do, so here I've actually taken the liberty of already setting up prolog. Let me see what I do. Here we are. Okay. So now if I, so I've loaded up that file and actually some other files that I'll use. So I won't bore you with how you load up files. So I say accept. What was it called? Binary odd, I think. And I'll give it a sequence, 1, 0, 1, 1, or something like that. Then it says yes. Yes means I can find you a proof. If I say accept 0, 1, or something like that, won't accept that one. I could do slightly more fancy things. I could do something. I could ask it something like, "Is it possible to accept any three-element sequence that has a zero as the first element?" Which should be no, right? So if I say, I could say zero anything. The underscores mean any variable here. Oh, sorry. X equals 0, anything. So what that's saying, if I got it right, is this is a three-element sequence. It's got a 0 here, and then I don't care what this is, and I don't care what this is. Can I accept it as binary odd? It says no.
Mm?
Here? Yes. I'll show you. I thought it was clearer the other way, but I could do this. Zero. Okay. So I don't want to dwell a whole lot on all of these examples. I'm going to give you a whole lot of stuff, so I'm not here to teach you prolog. Don't start asking me lots and lots of questions. Oh, we never get to the end. I do one example. We never get to the end. I can give you 6 lectures on prolog if you like, but I won't.
When you use the underscore, is it trial of
possibilities? It is trying all the possibilities. Well, that's not because of the underscore directly, but in this case, it is trying all the possibilities. Okay, so that's the bit about binary odd. I have another example here, actually, just to conclude this. I won't go back to the slides because then I'll have to go back in and out again. But another example you saw, if you remember, was probabilistic finite state machines, right? So you had, remember the first one I gave where you had the probabilities on the transitions? Okay, I did one for that as well for you. So here's one that's slightly different, The transition function is a little different. Here we're putting probabilities on the transitions rather than just being simple transitions, crisp transitions. Okay? And that's the only real difference. So it's a probabilistic except we have probabilities on the transitions now. And then here's the definition of a probabilistic except. It's exactly the same as before, except, actually, I'm not going to explain this to you in detail because it takes me a little time to explain how you do set operations in logic programs. Think of this as being a piece of magic. It's not, because it's a computation, that tries all of the solutions, puts them all together for you. Okay, that's what Bagov does, and there's a family of things that does this in a logic programming language. And this thing here takes the sum of them. So that's the bit that does the sum over the probabilities. And the clever bit is that this thing is calling this one exhaustively, so it's giving you all the traces with their probabilities, P. And then for each trace, it's taking the product. Remember, for the traces through the probabilistic finite state machines, each trace you take the product, over all the traces you take the sum. That's what this is doing in a very compact way. Okay? So I don't want to get into details of that, or we're here for the rest of the lecture and beyond, but that's what that's doing. Let me give you the model. So what model have I got here? Oh yeah, I did this one. Let me draw out the transitions for you again. I'm sorry, these boards are just horrible. What's the best way to do it? I'll keep working with this guy. Probably by the time I've written it down, you maybe have worked out what the model is anyway. So that particular model up there, we have the transition. Now, the starting state is 1 again. That's 1. And then we have a first transition state. So we go from 1 with the character A to 1. So that's going back. Too short. That's the character A and has probability 0.6. Second transition says I can go from 1 to state 2 with the A. Okay. State 2. That's with A, and the probability is probably 0.4. Yeah, 0.4. And then the third one says I can go from 1 to 3. Whoops. To 3. Oh, sorry, this is terrible. Board. To 3 with a B, with probability 1. I won't write the 1 on. And then I can also go from 2 to B, so 2 with B to 3. That's another B. Again, it's probability 1. And from 3 to 4, with what? An A. Okay, so that goes with an A. And what are the, 4 is the only except state. So that's the except state. There you are. I think I got that right. Okay, so that's what that thing says. Wait, look, comes back. So you can kind of see the only way we can get to an except state is through something that ends in B and A. But there's different routes to doing that. There's a B and an A. There's a B and an A. Okay. So then I could do this one if I do... where are we? P except. And what was it? Prob was the name of the model. And I've got, I don't know, A, B, A or something. P. Oh, that's because I put in a BA and it won't accept that. Prob, A, B, A. 0.6 for that one. Okay? So that's by way of introducing you to a little bit of prologue. Let me get back to my slides now, wherever they have gone. Okay. That's that. Okay, the other thing I wanted to do, I promised to you I'd talk a little bit about grammars. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about grammars. Here's a grammar example. So this, the way grammars work is they give you another way of being able to process sequences. And I am not going to explain to you the gory details of how you deal with grammars in Prolog. The basic principle of getting a dealing with a grammar is you define grammar rules. And the grammar rules allow you to construct a parse tree by following through the rules. Actually, it looks an awful lot like a proof tree. And in Prolog, it is a proof tree of a special kind. But in Prolog, it's a special proof tree where every step in the proof is chewing bits out of the grammar, chewing bits out of the sequence. So you're going through the proof, and every time you take a step in a proof, it involves chewing up a symbol from the sequence, or maybe more than one sometimes, which is a very, very powerful thing to be able to do, because essentially you can apply all of the power of a logic program to defining the grammar. You can make very complex grammars this way. Here's an example. So then here's my grammar. This symbol here, which you haven't seen before, is basically defining one sequence in terms of other subsequences. And that is directly analogous through a translation that occurs when you actually load up the grammar into Prolog to Prolog clauses. This is actually a Prolog clause, where these guys here imply this guy here. Why is it a special symbol rather than implication? It's because in order to imply this one, these guys here are chewing up behind the scenes bits out of the sequence. It's done through a translation into the underlying logic clauses, which I will not describe to you because there's not enough time. So what this says intuitively is the sequence represented by S corresponds to the sequence corresponding to NP, which noun phrase, followed by the sequence corresponding to VP, verb phrase. In other words, sentence consists of a noun phrase segment followed by a verb phrase segment. Similarly here, a noun phrase can be a noun, or a noun phrase can be a terminer followed by a noun. Verb phrase is a verb followed by a noun phrase. Okay. Then down here, the things in brackets are vocabulary. So these are the symbols in the sequence. So this says a noun can be the symbol cat. A noun can be, alternatively, a symbol mouse. So these are or choices, separate clauses. We could choose them separately. And then the idea is, if you have a sequence like the cat eats the mouse, you want to know whether it's conformant to the grammar. Does it parse? This does, and here's why. The is a determiner. There's a determiner, the. Cat is a noun. Eats is a verb. There's a determiner. Mouse is a noun. Right? And then you can succeed with noun phrase if it's a determiner followed by a noun. There, that's that rule. Here's another noun phrase, a determiner followed by a noun. Verb phrase is a verb followed by a noun phrase. We go to noun phrase here, we go to verb here. There's the verb phrase. Sentence is a noun phrase followed by a verb phrase. There you are. So you're just building it up. Right, so let me show you what this looks like in Prolog. Where are we? Actually, I want to get rid of this guy now. It's a bit small. Let's make it a bit bigger. Okay. That's what it looks like in Prolog. The same, actually. Right? The only difference is the full stops, which is just a way of telling Prolog that you've put in a clause. That gets loaded up into Prolog, which I already did. And it actually, once it's loaded up, it looks like normal horn clauses, not like that special syntax. But I'm not going to explain that to you. What I'll do is I'll just kind of show you. So now if I do S, the cat eats the mouse, right? Now, you'll be wondering, why did I type it like this, as something that has arguments to it and with an empty list at the end? That's because of the way it's translated in, actually. Everything gets translated into things with two extra arguments that are the input sequence and whatever's left over after you've finished, for reasons that I won't describe, but that's just what happens. You just have to trust me that that's necessary. So then if I want to say, what this is doing is saying, does this sequence parse with nothing left over according to the grammar S? And the answer is yes. But then, of course, I can do, this is, you could write functional programs to do this, but I can do more than that. I can say, what sequences can I generate, right? So what this one is saying is, generate me a sentence, right? And I'm using the same, I use the same grammar, right? And then I start finding out I can generate all sorts of things from my grammar. Look at all that. Whoa, lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of sequences, right? This is a logic program. It's not one of your puny functional programs. And Phil, if you're watching this video, right? So I want to go, oh, sorry, I got carried away there. Don't worry about it. I could have kept going. I typed in a wrong symbol there somewhere. Oh, there was a no, actually. Those are all the ones that it can generate, actually. I exhaustively generated all the sequences that that particular grammar and that vocabulary could generate, right? And it's the same grammar. I didn't have to write a different program to do that. That was the same program, right? Very nice, very nice. So that's that one. Let's get on a little bit here. Oh wow, I'm gonna be pushed for time, but let's try. Oh, actually that's where I was gonna explain the translation, but I'm not going to do that for you. Actually, that's the direct translation underneath. I'd forgotten that I had a slide about that. That's actually how it translates. What happens when it loads it up is it does all of this stuff automatically that puts in the extra pairs of arguments that looks after all of it. But underneath, it's logic. Do I have time for this? Yes, just. I'll have to rush through this. So I did want to give you an example of something that was not, because I thought there'd be more people who'd used. I suspect those of you who have seen logic programming before will be going, yeah, this is logic program, I saw you before. You may not have seen stuff that's to do with constraint solving, which you now get inside many logic programming languages. Here's a constraint solving problem. I'll give you two. So this is the first one, which is a simpler one. I'll get through this one very quickly. I'll get through them both actually very quickly, given the time constraints. This is an arithmetic puzzle, so maybe you've seen puzzles like this before. Then the idea is, you have a bit of arithmetic here. These things are variables. So you have S is a variable, E is a variable, and so on. And the variables have to match. So the O here has to be the same as the O here. The E here has to be the same as the E here and here. Okay? That's your puzzle. And you've got the numbers between 0 and 9. And what you want is to replace all the variables here with numbers so that each variable is different and the sum is correct. It's the sort of thing you get as little puzzles, and you'll get them in magazines and so on to do this kind of thing. Okay, and it's quite difficult. You have to think of all the combinations and get that to work. And so this would be that question mark thing is what you've already seen in your logic in your Prolog interpreter. What you want is a program that will solve this for you. Okay. Now let me, and that's an answer that would be legitimate. All I'm going to do is. I was going to show you the Prolog code, but actually I'd forgotten I have it on the slide. Actually, here's the bit of logic programming that will do this for you. So here's your solve money thing, send more money, and it's going to, actually I don't have time to go into this in detail, so I just kind of do a bit of hand waving here, I'm afraid. So there's a bit that does the addition for you, and there's a bit. Now, this is something that's a primitive in this particular constraint language. It sends a constraint down to the problem solver underneath that says, make sure these variables are all different. And then this one is the guy that says, now label the variables. Choose some for me. So this is something you haven't seen before. And actually, if you've done logic programming in a simpler style before, you won't have seen. These things here are giving you constraints between the variables. This says, the variable A has between 0 and 9. It's not assigning a value to the variable. It's just saying, here's the range. This says the variable B has to be between 0 and 9. It's just saying, here's the range. It's not choosing a value, which is the other programs you've seen always chose a value whenever. And this guy is placing in an arithmetic constraint. It's saying C has to be A plus B plus the next carry modulo 10, because that's the way you're doing the addition. Basically, you're doing a little definition of what it means to do the addition. Okay, and all of this is just supplying constraints. It's saying this variable is constrained to be in this range. There are arithmetic ranges, ranges expressed just as ranges of numbers. Sets up all of those constraints. The whole thing rips through and sets up a big set of constraints. And at the end, only at the end, does it go through and solve all of those in one pass. And if you have the type of problem where that suits, these sort of programs can be very, very efficient. So that's why I'm mentioning them now. Okay, so let me just in case you don't believe me, where are we? So if I say, what was it called? Solve money, I think. It gives you a set, and you can get them, of course, since it's a logic program, you can generate more solutions if they exist. Where are we? Oh, it's that one. Yeah. Lots of different solutions for this one. Of course, as I type them in, you're checking them mentally. you have to trust me that these are legitimate solutions. So it can generate the solutions for you. Okay, but really, this is on I want to get the other example in before we finish, and then that's the last example I'm going to give you. So where was I? Here. Okay, so this is the example I want to kind of finish up on, which is Sudoku. I guess you all know Sudoku, do you? Do I have to, you know, these puzzles where you have to, oh, well, this is the definition of it. You complete the table so that numbers in each box, row and column are different, and you use integers 1 to 9, and everybody does this sort of thing, and it's tremendously complicated, and it takes you hours to do, and it drives you nuts. But people like to do that. Okay, so that's an example problem. This problem is I mean, you can mentally try to work on it now if you like. I believe this one is quite difficult. And then the idea, here's Sudoku defined as a constraint solving problem. So Sudoku puzzle, 9 rows solved if we give all the 81 variables. 81 variables in the puzzle, that's easy. You restrict the domain of each variable between 1 and 9. That's a bit like the problem that you saw before. You ensure that all the variables in each row, column, and box have different values. That's another constraint, right? Do that for all the columns and rows. Ensure that the values required by the specific settings are given to the appropriate variables, by which I mean, you know, those things there. That one has to be a 1. That one has to be a 4. They're set. Everything else is just you're defining the ranges, right? And there's a consistent choice of instances for all the variables given those constraints, right? That's it defined as a logic program, which looks a bit hairy, but a lot of it is being replicated. Actually, the real program is slightly more complex because you're just seeing more stuff here. I've paraphrased bits here. So this is the bit where you say, here are all the variables. That's your set of variables. That's your board, right? That's the top row, so it's A1, A2, A3, and so on. And here's your squares are inside here, right? I guess you can sort of see that, right? Happy with that? So this is really your board, all your variables, and by knowing the position, then you can guess where the squares are. This says, this domain thing just sets all of these variables to between 1 and 9. It's like going through it for each variable and setting the 1 to 9. So it's just a quicker way of doing it, okay? This gives you your rows. This says row 1 is that. So row 1 is there. It's these variables, look, A1, A2, okay? Here are your columns. A1, B1, C1, D1, that's one column, right? There it is, column 1, boop. And you do that for every one, which is why the program gets bigger in real life. I do this for every row, from row 1 to row 9. I do this one for every column, from column 1 to column 9. So these dots are bits I missed out, so I could put it on the slide, right? Then I do it for the boxes. Here's a box, A1, this set. There's a box. I just define them, because that's a simple thing to do. No problem at all. It's just a data structure. Then this constraint says row 1, they all have to be different. And I do the same for every one of these rows. So all different is a constraint that says they all have to be different. It's passing information back to the underlying constraint solver. Do that for all of these. And then the constrained puzzle is the only bit here that's specific to the particular puzzle. It's the bit that says, here where the particular things have to have particular values. So that, if you can kind of hold it in your mind, look at that one there. There's a 1, there's a 4. That's all that is just there. There's a 1, there's a 4, right? I formatted it for you so you could easily see. There we are. And then this guy says, label the variables, given all those constraints. Do it. Okay? So that's So that's, I hope you agree, that's a very, very neat, precise definition of what it means to solve a Sudoku puzzle. So this is the, and this is, it says, it's a, this is a single axiom, right? Wow, one big axiom in logic. Then here are its arguments. These are your, these are your definitions for each one of the rows. Okay, so if I say go, how many of these are there? B, C, D, E, F, G, H. Right. Let me see if I can do this. And then we'll stop after I see if I can get this to work. So now if I do go, so I already loaded this up, B, C. Right, and so we're going to do, how long do you think it's going to take if I type it in right? How long do you think? What? Faster than that. it turns these things into trivial problems. A nice thing I can do is, remember, this is a logic program, so I can say, is this solution unique? Because I can type semicolon. Are there more solutions? Do you think there are more solutions? No, it's unique. So this is a really difficult Sudoku puzzle. If you try to do this one, I think this is actually one from, I can't remember, is it Times or Telegraph or somewhere, considered to be fiendish. Actually, I should thank Peter Ross, actually, was the guy who actually wrote this. The first time I saw one of these guys, it was Peter Ross, and I'm using his software here. This is not mine. So that's an example of the sort of thing where the reason I'm giving you this example is because it's Sudoku, and because I quite like the idea of making people think, Jesus, why am I spending all my time doing this Sudoku puzzles when I could be doing something useful? I like revising for informatics. One, computational logic would be more intellectually stimulating than doing Sudoku, believe me, because you can automate these things very, very fast. Much better if you learned how to write the program that would do it automatically for any Sudoku than to do lots of Sudokus, right? So that's one reason. The other reason I'm giving you this just at the end is just to give you this kind of feeling for how, when you for some problems, not for them all, for some things, logic programming is just not the appropriate thing to do. But for some problems, you get a very crisp specification, plus, and this is the thing where people sometimes don't quite get it, plus also an incredibly efficient solution to particular problems. You have to choose your problem right, and you have to be able to represent the knowledge, the axioms, correctly. But if you can do that, bingo. You end up with something that universally can solve Sudoku puzzles and lots of other things. So, actually, that wasn't bad for time. That's me finished. See you next time.
Slow for things that it doesn't suit.
I don't know. I mean,
for example, why it's better than functional languages. You can do both things in both functional languages.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
The only thing is that you have to be like.
Yeah, I mean, people used to argue about that an awful lot. Was it better to be a functional? Because I used to be an AI community, and we used to have arguments about, we used to have arguments about whether functional programming was something to listen for us actually at that time, because there was no reason in Java or anything like that. Was that better to use Lisp or use Prologue? And people used to argue for ages. There never was a solution to it. Because it depends. Sometimes your problems have a very, very elegant solution functionally. For others, you have very, very elegant solutions for logic programs. Often, the ones that suit best, I think, for logic programs are ones where really there is a strong notion of constraint, and you want to have lots of backtracking to generate solutions. Then those things tend to suit logic programming. And if not, then
possibly not. Also written for is very good for things where you want to write things that you can understand as interpreting other languages. Auto programs are lovely for that. But then for other things, very they get, I don't know, naturally sort of some kind of array type operation. Well, sure, you do array as well, but it's just a function. It depends. Everything is in each language nowadays, including Java.
Can you point me at any online resources around for having been looking at this?
I think the thing to do, the simple thing to do, if you want to actually get your hands dirty with something like Prolog, is use the dice, use Sixtus on dice. It's possible to get for Sixtus Prolog, you can get free Prologs of different kinds, which you can just look on the web and try and pull across what you want. It's SWR, still free, but there's a free version you can just get on the dice machines. I mean, if you're really fanatically